America Phoenix, 1010 Talk, KXXT, proudly presents The Charles Goyette Show. Call 602-230-8255. That's 602-230-TALK. And now, Fearless Talk Radio. Here's Charles Goyette.
Golly, Mr. Governor, you're the bestest governor ever. Harriet Myers, who thinks George W. Bush is the smartest man she's ever met, in the letter that she wrote to Bush when he was governor of Texas. Golly, Mr. Governor, you're the bestest governor ever, signed Harriet Myers. And Bush thought, you know, she should be on the high court. She's obviously been smoking something. That's why they call it the high court. Hey, good morning. It's Charles Goyette. This is Air America Phoenix, 1010 Talk, KXXT. And thank you very much for joining me on my program. I'm going to try to take on a task as a public service to you today, to new listeners to Air America Phoenix, 1010 Talk, KXXT, to people who weren't paying a lot of attention to the stories about the war as they developed. Who believed that if the government says we have to have war to protect ourselves, they must be right, and we're going to trust them, and who would never imagine that the government would be capable of betraying our trust. I'm going to provide a public service to you because we have stories that are beginning to bubble up now that perhaps involve senior officials of the Bush administration being indicted, charges of conspiracy. Charges of criminal activity at the highest levels in the Bush administration, perhaps indictments of some senior administration officials, perhaps unindicted co-conspirators going all the way to the top. You have a special prosecutor, you have grand juries, you have talk about. Well, on this show, you have talk about frog marching some of these perpetrators out of the White House in handcuffs. You've got stories about Scooter Libby and Valerie Plame and Joseph Wilson and Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and grand juries and Matthew Cooper. And there are people that are trying to make sense of this, that are coming to this story a little bit late, trying to understand what is all this about. And I have been very, very concerned that the focus, look, the media has got an attention span of like a gnat. You know, a gnat has a lifespan of 18 hours, and so it's got an attention span of a couple of seconds. That's the media. And I'm afraid that for the most part, the national news media in America will think that this story is really about a conspiracy to out Valerie Plame. It's about who talked to Bob Novak and why didn't he tell us the truth. It's about Judith Miller and why did Judith Miller really go to jail? Was she really protecting the First Amendment, or was she more serious about rejuvenating her career after helping lie this country into war on the basis of misleading information that she got on the front pages of the New York Times? What is the story really about, though? It's about something much larger than Valerie Plame being outed, and about Joseph Wilson being trashed, and about Judith Miller going to jail, and about frog marching Karl Rove out of the White House. And you have all of these events starting to converge at once. Look, President Bush's primary advisor is Karl Rove. He's going to be questioned again for the fourth time before a grand jury about the improper naming of a CIA official. Do you know that the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded the other day to Mohammed al-Baradei, who is the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency? Mohammed al-Baradei is the guy a week before the war said none of the things this administration has been telling you. He reported officially, we can't find any evidence. We've been everywhere. There is no evidence. There is no justification for the rationale for this war. The Bush administration has been hell-bent on removing him from office, but in a slap in the face of the Bush administration last week, the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded to Mohammed al-Baradei for having been right about the things that he said. You have a Pentagon official pleading guilty to passing on classified information to Israel or to representatives or sympathizers of Israel. You have all of these events converging at once, and yet someplace in the story, in danger of being lost is what it's really all about. And I'll tell you what it's really all about. It breaks down into three parts: wanting war, selling war, and starting a war. So I'm going to try to tell you some of the highlights that'll put some of this into perspective, and then we'll open up the phones and take calls about it. First of all, let me tell you that it is about wanting war. And probably there's no better place to start the story. You are looking at almost 2,000 American deaths in Iraq now. At least, I think we're at least 1,950 American deaths in Iraq. The number of wounded, officially the number of wounded Americans is around 15,000, but it may actually go as high as 40,000 that are somehow wounded or disabled in some capacity. Those are Americans. What about Iraqi casualties? 26,000 at the low-end estimates, 120,000 needless deaths at the high-end, deaths that needn't have happened. Who would want a war that would end in that kind of carnage? How do we know that Bush wanted a war? That's where I'd like to start with you. Because the fact that Bush wanted a war is the very easiest thing to document in this whole deal. Look, Paul O'Neill had worked for President Nixon. He'd worked for President Ford. He'd been the chairman of Alcoa. And he was the Treasury Secretary when the Bush administration came into office. Paul O'Neill said that in meeting with Bush, there was no free flow of ideas or open debate. At cabinet meetings, Paul O'Neill said this, he was like a blind man in a room full of deaf people. And at the very first National Security Council meeting as Treasury Secretary, he was a part of those meetings. At the very first meeting, well before 9/11, a year and 9 months before 9/11 ever happened to the United States, from the beginning, at the very first National Security Council meeting, it was all about Saddam Hussein. Bad person, he needed to go. That was topic A. 10 days after the inauguration and months before the attack on America. Day one. It was all about Iraq and regime change in Iraq. Did the administration tell you that when they ran for office? When the president was sworn in, did he tell you that? And Paul O'Neill, as a member of the Security Council, say, why Saddam? Why now? Those questions were never answered. The president was saying from the beginning, go find me a way to do this. It was about preemption from the beginning. And at the next National Security Council meeting, 2 days later, it was the same thing. Plans for post-Saddam Iraq were circulated at the second National Security Council meeting. This all before 9/11. Plans for the occupation of Iraq were talked about in January and February. It's the easiest thing in the world to document the fact that President Bush wanted a war. When he ran for governor of Texas, they centered on a popular sports writer in Houston to ghostwrite his campaign biography, his official biography. They picked Mickey Hershkowitz. As it happened, I believe Karen Hughes ended up finally writing the official biography of Bush when he ran for governor. Mickey Hershkowitz was in the process of interviewing the candidate to write the book when George W. Bush said, yeah, when you get in office, you get a lovely little war, a splendid little war, and then pick a country you can beat, and then your numbers go way up and you're real popular. The idea that these people came into office wanting a war is the simplest thing, the easiest thing to document. You have heard people talk about the Project for the New American Century, PNAC, Project for the New American Century. This is an organization that was formed in 1997. In the fall, in September of 2000, a year before 9/11, a document landed on my desk called Rebuilding America's Defenses. They sent me a copy of a policy document from PNAC, the Project for a New American Century. What was it about? It was about an aggressive military plan for the United States to dominate the entire world militarily for the next century. This was not your ordinary think tank. It wasn't your ordinary policy paper. These PNAC members, this was before Bush was elected president. And they all ended up holding key positions in the White House, in the Defense Department, in the State Department. The people who had authored or signed off on this plan for U.S. military domination of the entire world for a year. Among the signers and the members were Dick Cheney, if the name rings a bell, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Elliot Abrams, Louis Libby, John Bolton, William Kristol, who was the editor of the Weekly Standard, was the chairman of the group, Zalmay Khalilzad, who is the United States ambassador to Iraq today, was a member of the group, William Bennett, Dan Quayle, Jeb Bush, if the name rings a bell. And their policy documents were talking about waging multiple simultaneous large-scale wars. But the first order of business, This is before Bush was elected, before 9/11. Their first order of business was the removal of Saddam Hussein and a permanent U.S. military presence in the Middle East. It was a world empire dominated by the United States. And here is what they said. So you don't think that this is an off-the-wall conspiracy theory. This is what the Project for the New American Century wrote in the Rebuilding America's Defenses document. The process of transformation, in other words, bringing about their ideas, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. In other words, to get our plan, if something bad happens, then we can get our plan. So the idea that these people didn't want a war, I mean, this is the easiest thing to establish. They were on the record in think tanks and in their private life wanting a war. Immediately after 9/11, they kicked the plan into gear. I mean, hours after Flight 77 flew into the Pentagon, Rumsfeld was telling his aides to come up with plans for striking Iraq. There had been no evidence linking Saddam Hussein to the attack on Iraq. Immediately, generate plans to attack Iraq. British ambassador to the United States, Sir Christopher Meyer, said that President Bush asked Tony Blair to support the removal of Saddam Hussein within 9 days after 9/11. No evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved in the attacks. Already, Tony Blair is being asked to sign on 9 days after 9/11. Now, I suppose we could get into the Downing Street memo and spend a whole day on that. But the Downing Street memo is important to understand the backdrop of all these things. British intelligence, a senior British official, Sir Richard Dearlove, the head of British intelligence, went to Washington, D.C., had meetings at the highest levels of the CIA and the White House and other official areas, and he said, this is what we're going to have. Military action against Iraq is inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by a conjunction of terrorism and WMDs, but he wrote intelligence and the facts were being fixed around the policy. This is June of 2002, the Downing Street memo. Bush, in the meantime, is lying to the American people for months after this. Oh, I haven't made up my mind. I haven't made up my mind that I want a war. But let me tell you what happened in the White House in July of 2002. While Bush is telling the American people, oh, no, peace, peace. We don't want a war if we don't have to. I haven't made up my mind. Richard Haass, senior State Department official, has a meeting with the president. He's in the White House. He's talking to Condoleezza Rice. They're talking about Richard Haass comes in with alternatives to a war, how to deal with some of the problems in the Middle East, the war on terror, and more. His primary objective is to forestall, to fend off a needless war with Iraq. Condoleezza Rice tells him in these words, save your breath. He's already decided. July 2002, Richard Haass told, save your breath. Bush has already made up his mind. In the meantime, Bush is shifting troops from Afghanistan to Iraq. Wait a minute. The troops in Afghanistan were in the hunt for Osama bin Laden, who we have clearly been told attacked us on 9/11. Was the perpetrator, was wanted dead and alive, dead or alive. But in 2002, they began to move troops from the pursuit of Osama bin Laden into Iraq, staging areas for invasion of Iraq. Florida Senator Bob Graham was told by General Tom, and he told me on the radio, Florida Senator Bob Graham told me on the radio, General Tommy Franks told him that we had taken resources off the hunt for Osama bin Laden to prepare for war in Iraq. And you wonder how Osama bin Laden became Osama bin Forgotten. That's sort of the background, the high points on they wanted a war. It was clear from the very beginning in official position papers, in all of their orientation from before this administration came into office, from before we were attacked, that this was their number one objective. Did they tell the American people that during the campaign? As soon as we get in office, our first national security meetings are going to be about how can we attack Iraq. Did they tell you that during the campaign? I'm afraid not. But they wanted war, and we could literally spend a week buttressing the testimony and the evidence for that. But it is so clear, it's indisputable, that they wanted a war from the beginning. Now you ask yourself, what kind of person wants a war? I'll go you one better. What kind of people sell a war on the basis of fraudulent information? what kind of human beings send people to their deaths, what kind of people beat the drums of fear to sell war to the American people when it's unnecessary. I'll tell you what kind of people when we continue in a moment. Air America Phoenix 1010 Talk KXXT and the Charles Goyette Show is on the air. This is a public service portion of our program this morning. The backstory to all of the Valerie Plame frog marching Scooter Libby, Patrick Fitzgerald grand jury Judith Miller story. What is it really all about? It's not about outing a source. It's not about disclosing the undercover identity of Valerie Plame in the CIA. Yeah, that's a component of it. That's a constituent element of it. But the larger story that cannot be forgotten is that it's about lying this country into war, betraying the trust of the American people. The Bush administration came into office and was built on a consortium of neocons who wanted a war and had been lobbying for a war for years, had written to President Clinton asking him to invade Iraq for the oil. The Bush administration was peopled with those people, people that wanted a war, and then went about the business of selling the war. Now, you talk about conspiracy theories. Well, conspiracies do happen. They're not always hidden. They're not always in the dark. The truth often comes out later. But a bunch of people do get together from time to time to plan things. And that is exactly what happened in the White House in the summer and fall of 2002 before the war. In August, Dick Cheney started equating Saddam Hussein with nuclear weapons. August of 2002, they were ready to really start marketing the soap to the American people. They had formed in the White House a secret group called the White House Iraq Group. These weren't intelligence analysts. They weren't military analysts. They weren't veteran analysts of international situation. They were PR flacks. They were spinmeisters, and it was a marketing effort charged with the responsibility of selling the war to the American people. How would the White House Iraq Group convince the American people that we had to go to war to make the American public safe? And they came up with mushroom clouds. And the rhetoric started to escalate. It was mushroom clouds in every debate after the formation of the White House Iraq Group. They said it was a group to educate the public, but they diseducated the public. They began to create and represent threats that did not exist. Andrew Card was the chief of staff and of the White House. And at each stage of the confrontation with Baghdad, they started talking about nuclear threats, mushroom clouds. They began to make a major press offensive in the fall of 2002, representing that Iraq had a robust nuclear weapons program, and they meant for it all to top out in a presidential speech in Cincinnati in October. In September of 2002, in an interview with the New York Times, Andrew Card, he didn't disclose the existence of the White House Iraq Group, but he said this: from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August. They waited until after Labor Day. And after Labor Day, they began to really sell the war and the mushroom clouds really, really hard to the American people. Card said the administration waited until after Labor Day to try to sell the American people on military action against Iraq. Who were the White House Iraq Group? Who were these people? Karl Rove? Spinmeister campaigner. Karen Hughes, spinmeister campaigner. Mary Madeline, spinmeister campaigner. James Wilkinson was a deputy national security advisor for communications, means spinmeister. I think Wilkinson now is I don't remember what position he holds now. Spinmeister. Nicholas Calayo is a now top lobbyist, senior vice president lobbyist for Citigroup. Condoleezza Rice was a member. Stephen Hadley was a member. And Scooter, what kind of grown man calls himself Scooter Libby, was a member of the Iraq White House group. After Labor Day, September 7th and 8th, Bush and all of his top advisors began to blanket the airways talking about mushroom clouds and the threat posed by Iraq. Vice President Cheney went on Meet the Press to talk about the development of stockpiles of weaponry, about their aggressive development of nuclear weapons over the past 14 months. CNN, Condoleezza Rice goes on CNN talking about how close Iraq may be to obtaining nuclear weapons, and we don't want the smoking gun to be in the form of a mushroom cloud. They were all on the same printed talking points. President Bush on CBS said UN weapons inspectors, before they were denied access to Iraq, concluded that Saddam was 6 months away from developing a weapon. President Bush said he was developing nuclear arms, trying to develop nuclear weapons, and he said, I don't know what more evidence we need. Judith Miller, New York Times. Yes, the same Judith Miller who spent time in jail. After Labor Day, she started helping the Bush administration roll out the story. Front page of the New York Times right after Labor Day, Judith Miller with the story, in the last 14 months, Iraq has sought to buy thousands of specially designed aluminum tubes, which American officials believe were intended as components of centrifuges to enrich uranium. Front page of the New York Times. Of course, American officials didn't believe that. Department of Energy officials were laughing at the idea. October of 2002, Bush says to Saddam, this is a man we know has connections with Al-Qaeda. This is a man who, in my judgment, would use Al-Qaeda as a forward army. They were selling war to the American people. January 2003, State of the Union address. Bush says of Saddam Hussein, he has weapons of mass destruction, the world's deadliest weapons, which pose a direct threat to the United States, our citizens, and our friends and allies. In the self-same State of the Union address, the administration has President Bush saying the British government has recently learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. But of course it wasn't true, and the administration already knew it. And I'll tell you about that when we continue in a moment. The Charles Goyette Show from 1010 Talk, KXXT. It's Air America Phoenix, 1010 Talk, KXXT, and the Charles Goyette Show. I hope to get to the phones here in a couple of minutes. Our telephone number is 602-230-8255, but I'm doing what I think is an important public service act here on the radio show today, because the airwaves are thick and will grow thicker with stories about frog marching officials out of the White House in handcuffs, with grand juries, with indictments, with special prosecutors. The stories about Matthew Cooper and Judith Miller and Valerie Plame and Joseph Wilson and Bob Novak, and what are they all really about? They are all about the way this administration came into office wanting a war, selling us a war on the basis of fraudulent information, starting a war, and then seeking to destroy the people who revealed their cynical deception. That's the backstory that we're telling today. And we've talked a lot about how they wanted a war and the evidence for that and how they sold the war. Selling the war actually culminated with the President's State of the Union address several months before war broke out, 3 months before our preemptive war on Iraq. In January of 2003, when President Bush said that the British government has recently learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the speechwriter's art. They knew that it wasn't true. How could they let the president say this in their campaign to sell fear of nuclear weapons and mushroom clouds to the American people, since they know it's not true? They wrote it in a way, it is the gift, the craft of the speechwriter, to give the president deniability. I didn't say that Saddam Hussein had mushroom clouds. I said we recently learned from the British government. But they knew that that wasn't true at the time. 3.5 months earlier, CIA Director Tenet had told Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley to take a line out of a Bush speech scheduled for October about Iraq attempting to obtain uranium. In October, the CIA director had told Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, who is today the National Security Advisor, take the line out about the uranium. It was supposed to be the culminating speech of the drumbeat for war to be given on October 7th. The CIA told Hadley and the White House speechwriter to take it out, that it wasn't reliable, that it wasn't true. The CIA sent a memorandum to the White House giving additional details about the claim and about U.S. intelligence community's the results of the U.S. intelligence community's investigation, how it wasn't reliable. No reference to Iraqi uranium procurement appeared in Bush's October 7th speech. They took it out on CIA warnings that it was unreliable, but they figured out a crafty way to get it back in 3.5 months later in the State of the Union. And a month after that, weeks after that, General Powell shames himself at the United Nations, asserting that there is no doubt in my mind that Saddam was working to obtain key opponents to produce nuclear weapons. This is good, solid, reliable information, he said. And 6 weeks after he said it at the United Nations, we attacked Iraq. But a full year earlier, the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research sent General Powell a memo stating that the Iraqi attempts to obtain uranium weren't credible. He knew it a year before he went to the United Nations. U.S. intelligence officials had told Senate committees that the British report about Iraqi uranium weren't reliable. This is what Tenet tells us now. Does the United States go to war on the basis of foreign intelligence that we don't believe? We did. So Tenet tells Stephen Hadley, take the line out about the from the president's speech. They took the line out, but even so, the president went on in Cincinnati in October of 2000 to say that we were facing clear evidence of peril, that we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud, but the case was based on deceit, and the administration knew it by that time. January of 2003, 3 months before the war, Bush reports to Congress that Iraq did not report, they omitted their attempts to acquire uranium from their declaration to the UN. But the administration knew that they weren't true by that time. Condoleezza Rice keeps the charade going with an article in the New York Times in January of 2003, 3 months before the war, talking about how Iraq has failed to account for Iraq's efforts to get uranium from abroad when they knew that it wasn't true at that time. January of 2003, Mohammed al-Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, tells the Security Council that his inspectors have to date found no evidence that Iraq has revived its nuclear weapons program since the elimination of that program in the 1990s. Yet Bush continues with the drumbeat about mushroom clouds. State Department officials give the IAEA the information the agency requested about evidence to obtain uranium from Niger. The IAEA says, give us these documents that you're relying upon. Let us see these documents. Mohammed al-Baradei and the International Atomic Energy Agency report to the Security Council, we have found to date no evidence of ongoing prohibited nuclear or nuclear-related activities in Iraq. In March, less than 2 weeks before the war, Mohammed al-Baradei, who now has been justly awarded with the Nobel Peace Prize, told the United Nations Security, 2 weeks before the war, it didn't have to happen, ladies and gentlemen. He said the documents that we're relying upon between Iraq and Niger were not authentic. The allegations are unfounded. The documents were forgeries. Two weeks before the war, that didn't have to happen. The documents had been identified as forgeries. Bush couldn't wait. We couldn't wait. Al-Baradei says, after 3 months of intrusive inspection, we have found to date no evidence or plausible indications of the revival of a nuclear weapon program in Iraq. March 9th, a week, 10 days before the war, even General Powell acknowledges that the documents concerning the Niger uranium might be false. And about a week later, we go to war. In what legal pretext there was for this president to have this war, it did demand that he write a letter to the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President pro tempore of the United States Senate. The president did so on March 18th of 2003, justifying this war, according to the authorization passed by Congress, justifying this war with these words. These were necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. Signed sincerely, George W. Bush. The pretext for the war, the legal justification for the war, the president's required certification to the United States Senate and the House of Representatives that it was a war against the people who had planned the terrorist attacks on America September 11, 2001. And they knew that it wasn't true. The 9/11 Commission would later report that there was no collaborative relationship between the secular government of Saddam Hussein and the fundamentalist objectives of al-Qaeda. The 9/11 Commission said no collaborative relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda. Two weapons inspectors, both David Kaye, a neocon who wanted the war, and Charles Dolfer, the second weapons inspector, spent $1 billion U.S. dollars looking for weapons, for a pretext, for a post facto justification for the war, something to justify the war that had already been launched. $1 billion was spent in the search for weapons of mass destruction. David Kaye, Charles Dolfer, no weapons of mass destruction. The rationale for the war didn't exist. No certification from the President of the United States that the war was about a democracy, about registering voters, about creating a bicameral legislature in Baghdad. No representation about that. It was a war against the people who had planned the attacks on September 11th of 2001. Let me tell you about Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame when we continue in a moment. It's the Charles Goyette Show. The plot thickens. Straight ahead. It is the Charles Goyette Show, and thank you for joining me this morning and every morning from 6 until 9 o'clock right here on Air America Phoenix 1010 Talk KXXT. By the way, special thanks to the Phoenix New Times for, even though we're new, we're only a year old, for naming us the best news talk station in Phoenix. It's a great honor. We thank you very much for noticing, and we thank you for listening and for telling your friends about 1010 Talk. It is what I'm considering the public service component of our show. To tell you the backstory about all the news that'll be making headlines in the next couple of weeks, about conspiracies, about charges of conspiracy, about grand jury indictments, about Patrick Fitzgerald and Scooter Libby and Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame and Karl Rove, and where the story may go and what the grand jury may do is unknown. But you need to know the backstory about how this administration and these neocons came into office wanting a war before the attacks that they used to ration as a rationale for their war, how they sold the war to the American people like it was a marketing campaign for a laundry detergent, how they started the war, and how they sought to destroy the people who had revealed their deceit. If in this era, in this administration, the officials who've lied are promoted. Bolton goes to the UN, Wolfowitz goes to the World Bank. The people who told the truth, Lawrence Lindsay, the war is going to cost $200 billion, $100 to $200 billion, fired. Lawrence Lindsay, for saying the war could cost $100 billion, fired. We're coming up on $300 billion. Lawrence Lindsay, fired. Mohammed al-Baradei, who told us there was no evidence of a nuclear weapons program in Iraq before the war started, when we had time to stand down. Mohammed al-Baradei is trashed by this administration. John Bolton seeks to remove him from his position in the IAEA. Fortunately, the entire world doesn't follow the whims of the Bush administration. And the Nobel Peace Prize Committee has awarded the Nobel Peace Prize to Mohammed al-Baradei for being right instead of wrong. Let me take you to the story of Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame that shows you not only how the administration wanted a war and sold the war and started the war, but how they sought to destroy the people who revealed their deceit. Joseph Wilson was a decorated ambassador. He had served as acting ambassador to Iraq and gone toe-to-toe with Saddam Hussein during the first Iraq war, and had been commendated by the first President Bush for his performance in the first Iraq war. The CIA decided in February of 2002 to send Joseph Wilson to Niger to investigate reports about uranium. Was it true? We need to know. Joseph Wilson later wrote in the New York Times, "It is highly doubtful that any such transaction has taken place because, look, the uranium industry, thanks to the good work of people like Mohammed al-Baradei and the IAEA, is carefully regulated at every turn. Every drop of fissionable material is known. The uranium industry is regulated by a consortium of foreign companies that are in the business of selling equipment and monitoring nuclear activities and uranium activities around the world. And it's all monitored by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And Wilson briefs this conclusion to the CIA when he returns in March 2002. The CIA had told Joseph Wilson that this mission of his to Niger is in response to an interest expressed by the vice president that Dick Cheney wanted to know more. So the CIA, looking around, settled on Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who knew something about Africa from his long service there, and they dispatched him to find out the truth, and he came back and said, it's highly doubtful that any of this kind of transaction has taken place. George Tenet confirmed the CIA sent Wilson to Niger. Tenet said that Wilson was sent there on the CIA's own initiative. The CIA distributes a summary of Wilson's trip to the intelligence community on March 9, 2002, a full year before the war. Powell knows that it's been cooked up. When he goes to the United Nations in February of 2003, he takes out the Niger uranium story. It hasn't stood the test of time. But he relies on British misrepresentations, MI6 British intelligence misrepresentations about Iraq and its capabilities. Here is 10 Downing Street. Here is 10 Downing Street, the Tony Blair government's paper that they delivered about Iraq, its infrastructure of concealment, deception, and intimidation. The British government, their intelligence paper on Iraq and its capabilities was fraudulent. It was copied verbatim from an old Israeli magazine. It was plagiarized from the work of a graduate student at a California university. They just lifted the work from September of 2002 of a graduate student, and they pretended that it was intelligence information from the British government. And they packaged it up and called it Iraq, its infrastructure of concealment, deception, and intimidation. And it was plagiarized from a college student's paper. It's taken out of an essay written by a student named Ibrahim al-Marashi. He'd written a small paper for the Middle Eastern Review of International Affairs, and they plagiarized it. Six full paragraphs in one section. It was all cut and pasted, and they pretended that it was British intelligence to justify us into a war. A week, 2 weeks before the war, the State Department finally handed over to the International Atomic Energy Agency copies of the Niger letters. The IAEA guys looked at these, and in 15 minutes they say these are blatant forgeries. These are not authentic. The documents were so bad they purported to be signed by an official of the Niger government who hadn't even been an official of the Niger government for years before the document was dated. A high school student on the internet could have figured out that these documents that made their way into the president's case for war and the State of the Union address were forgeries. A high school student could have figured it out with a Google search in 15 minutes. In the meantime, Joseph Wilson writes a report that says what I learned in Iraq, and a report about what I didn't find in Iraq. And what he didn't find in Iraq is the same thing that $1 billion spent on both the weapons search by weapons inspector David Kay and the weapons search by Charles Dofer did not find as well. No weapons of mass destruction. In the meantime, Robert Novak, the syndicated columnist, says two senior administration officials gave him the name of Joseph Wilson's wife. She was an undercover CIA operative who was working on keeping this country safe from the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Novak says two senior administration officials gave me her name in his syndicated column. Novak went one step further, and he told Newsday magazine, I didn't even have to dig her name out. It was given to me. And that, ladies and gentlemen, pretty much leads us to where we are now. all of the grand jury, Roe's fourth visit to the grand jury, all of the headlines about Pat Patrick Fitzgerald and possible indictments and Judith Miller and covering up sources and whether it extends to Scooter Libby, who lied to whom, and Karl Rove, and who could be implicated and who could be a co-conspirator and who could be indicted. It all goes back to the Bush administration officials seeking to destroy people who threatened to tell the American public the truth about this war. The war that they wanted for years before Bush came into office. The war that they sold to us like they were marketing a new soft drink. The war that they started in the face of evidence that none of their representations were true. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where we are today. I'll fill in more parts of the story. Scott Ritter will join us on Thursday on this show. Next week, Karen Kwiatkowski will tell us the inside story about how they cooked the books in the Office of Special Plans, their own secret little intelligence agency, to give them the kind of intelligence the CIA wouldn't cook up for them. Those stories on future Charles Goyette shows. Thanks.